call our third case for today, 99-3354-W, State X Rel Siebert versus Philip Mott. We'll have our first attorney, Gregory Siebold, arguing for State X Rel Siebert.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Siebold. I represent petitioner Reuben George Siebert. He is an individual in secure detention in Winnebago County at this time. Mr. Siebert filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus with the Court of Appeals, which was denied. That is the reason for his petition to this court.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that microphone will not carry you unless you can get it close to you and talk.
I'll try and lean over, Justice. Thank you. The reason for Mr. Siebert's petition for writ of habeas corpus was the denial of an appeal that he filed arising out of the denial of a petition for supervised release under Chapter 980 of the Wisconsin statutes. That appeal was denied because his court-appointed counsel filed the appeal one day late. The notice of appeal arrived in Outagamie County Circuit Court on the 91st day. And therefore, the Court of Appeals, because this was a civil action, denied the appeal. We're in a somewhat unusual position today in that the parties agree on quite a bit. The parties, including the petitioner, the respondent, and the amici, agree that Mr. Siebert had a right to counsel, and in fact a constitutional right to counsel, arising out of his Chapter 980 petition for supervised release. The parties also agree that Mr. Siebert had the right to effective assistance of counsel. The parties agree that Mr. Siebert was not afforded those rights. And the parties agree that the Court of Appeals should be reversed.
So why are we here, counsel?
The reason we are here, Justice, is that the respondent believes that this court need not decide the issue of whether Mr. Siebert had a constitutional right to counsel because this case can be decided on the more narrow issue of the right to effective assistance of counsel. And also, the respondent believes that this matter should be remanded to the circuit court for the purpose of having a hearing on whether, in fact, Mr. Siebert asked for an appeal in a timely fashion such that his counsel behaved deficiently under the Strickland standard. The petitioner believes that he has a constitutional right to counsel, and the petitioner believes that this court needs to address that particular issue. And the reason is this. Under the Court of Appeals analysis, they did an analysis under State X Rel Schmelzer in the Wisconsin decision, which derives from Strickland, the United States Supreme Court decision. The Strickland analysis was basically, was there deficient conduct by counsel, and if so, was there prejudice? The Court of Appeals found that there was no prejudice, and therefore the petition for writ of habeas corpus was denied. Well, if this court decides this issue strictly on the issue of effective assistance of counsel, and under the more recent United States Supreme Court decision in Roe, the court simply finds that there is a presumption of prejudice, and therefore this matter has to be reversed and remanded. The problem is the Court of Appeals could basically go back and do the same thing it did this time. It could apply a Strickland-type analysis because there has been no finding that the Court of Appeals must afford the petitioner an Anders type of procedure, a no-merit brief. The reason that the appeal was denied was because the counsel filed the appeal late. Under Roe, there's a presumption of prejudice. This matter goes back. The court could say, okay, fine. The Court of Appeals could say, okay, fine. Now you're before us, but because this is a civil procedure, Chapter 98 proceedings are civil in nature, there is no Anders right to counsel, and therefore there is no right to a no-merit procedure, and therefore the procedure that the Court of Appeals used the previous en route to this case arriving at this court this time, the same procedure could be followed, and that would be constitutionally adequate. I submit to the court that that's not the case. So therefore, this court needs to address that issue. There is no question that the Court of Appeals that Mr. Siebert has a constitutional right to counsel. So therefore, this court should find that the court, that Mr. Siebert has that right, and instruct the Court of Appeals to afford Mr. Siebert and Anders a right to a no merit brief under 809.32, which derives after Anders and was supported by the McCoy case, as the court knows.
Help me with this, counsel. As I understand it, the state says that under the Brown reasoning, that 809.32 no merit procedure does apply. Do you disagree with that? I mean, it seems to me that there's agreement that you can handle it under statutory avenues rather than going to constitutional avenues.
Well, Your Honor, the way I see it, there are two issues. One is there a constitutional right? Yes, there is. How do you satisfy that constitutional right? The United States Supreme Court has said the Robbins decision that states have flexibility in deriving parameters, deriving processes to afford those rights. 809.32 does that in Wisconsin. We know that that's a constitutional way to afford a no-merit procedure. And I think what the respondent is saying is we already have that procedure, and what this court ought to do is afford relief under that procedure because it's already familiar to the lawyers in Wisconsin, to the courts in Wisconsin, and it's already been found constitutionally adequate. So I would submit to the court, and the third issue that I was going to get to today was what I think is really the tough decision for the court, and that is how do you afford Anders-type relief to a Chapter 980 defendant? Do you adopt 809.32? There's problems with that because the 809.32 procedure derives from 809.30, which is directed toward criminal defendants, and it has a 180-day timeline, allowing the courts and counsel to address post-verdict issues. But in a civil matter where you have the 4590 timeline, you don't have that 180 days. So it's like trying to stick, I think the state public defender said, putting a round peg in a square hole. I believe that this court can fashion a remedy, and the remedy could, as counsel have recognized, fall under one of three categories. One, the court could create a remedy out of whole cloth.
I'm sorry, say that again slowly.
The court could create a remedy out of whole cloth.
Okay.
Number two, the court could simply say, we will apply 809.32 to Chapter 980 cases and, in effect, abrogate the statute of limitations under 808.04 with regard to Chapter 980 proceedings. Or the court could somehow try and meld 809.32 and 808.04 into a workable solution.
What do you suggest we do?
I submit to the court that what should be done is that 809.32 ought to be followed. There ought to be a no-merit procedure. I think that in the circumstances here, the court can recognize that and condone or give its blessing, so to speak, to the procedure that's actually being followed right now by the public defender, which is an appeal is filed under 808.04. The court is asked to remand the matter to the trial court to address post-verdict issues. And then after those are addressed, the matter goes back up to the Court of Appeals, and the entire matter can be considered at one time. I, quite frankly, think that would be a bit of a Band-Aid, but a sufficient Band-Aid until the legislature gets around to adding 980 to the list of items that fall under 809.30 in Section
808.4. Now, that Band-Aid works for your case?
Certainly.
Right, because it's within that statute of limitations.
Correct.
All right. It won't work for other cases coming up unless they follow this kind of Band-Aid. So you're suggesting that this stay with the legislature, not with the court?
Actually, no, Your Honor. Justice, I perhaps I wasn't clear enough. I believe that the court ought to say that this is the law of Wisconsin unless and until the legislature adopts a better solution.
Okay, so you're saying that the court should amend 808.04 by adding in, inserting the words Chapter 980.
Not quite, Your Honor. And the reason is this. 809.32 and 809.30 have a method of addressing post-verdict issues at the trial court, even before it gets to the Court of Appeals. What I am suggesting is that the court should say, you file your appeal within the 90-day deadline, and once you get to the Court of Appeals, you ask the court to, in essence, stay the appeal, remand the matter to the trial court. You've preserved the appeal. You've preserved the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals. The trial court addresses the post-verdict issues, if there are any. The matter goes back up to the Court of Appeals. That would be a different process than simply adding 980 to the list.
That preserves the integrity of the statute.
That certainly does, Your Honor.
And so you follow the statute up to a point, 80804, up to a point, and then the Court of Appeals remands it.
That's correct,
that's
Justice.
How they deal with that.
That's correct.
We direct the Court of Appeals what to do with it.
That's correct, Justice.
And who's going to go to the legislature?
Well, my understanding is that this issue is already well within the radar scope of the legislature and the Judicial Council, and I'm assuming that this is an issue that will be addressed in short order.
Yeah, that's what I'm directing my question at. Are you familiar that the court has adopted a change to 809.32? It did that several weeks ago. It hasn't been published and it's not in effect yet, but it does not affect this case. It does not deal with Chapter 980.
I was not aware of that, Justice.
No problem. It won't affect the case.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Seibold, are you asking in this particular situation that the court go ahead and remand this case to the Court of Appeals, or are you asking that we remand it to the trial court?
I'm asking that you remand it to the Court of Appeals.
And what would we be directing the Court of Appeals to do in this situation?
You would be directing the Court of Appeals to do several things. One, afford Mr. Siebert court-appointed counsel. Number two, remand the matter to the Circuit Court for the purpose of addressing post-verdict issues, or post-decision issues in this case, such as effective assistance of counsel by the trial lawyer. And when those issues are resolved, take the matter back and address all of the issues in one fell swoop.
Why would we not just suggest to the Court of Appeals that they apply the Anders no merit approach and appoint new appellate counsel and find out if there's going to be a no merit report filed or not? Why would we ask them to send it back to the trial court?
Because in the solution that you proposed, Justice Crooks, it does not address the issue of effective assistance of counsel by the trial court. There's not a process for Mr. Siebert to be afforded effective assistance of counsel or a right of appeal as to effective assistance of counsel.
Well, isn't the argument here basically an argument that focuses on whether or not there was effective assistance by appellate counsel?
That is correct, Justice. But the effective assistance dealt strictly with filing the appeal on time.
Right.
Had appellate counsel done that, then I believe that appellate counsel would have followed the procedure that I'm suggesting, and that is de facto being followed by the state public defender, to my knowledge, right now, which is request the Court of Appeals to send the matter back down to determine if there are any issues that have to be addressed with regard to the effectiveness of trial counsel.
What issues would need to be addressed, though? Doesn't the Penson versus Ohio case from the United States Supreme Court stand for the proposition that it's ineffective as a matter of law if that no merit procedure is omitted because of some procedural flaw?
Yes, Justice Sykes, but I think what we're talking about are two different things. One is the effectiveness of appellate counsel, and the other is effectiveness of trial counsel. There's no question that that appellate counsel was ineffective. And in fact, I submit that Mr. Sieber was denied appellate counsel at all under an Anders reading. However, part and parcel of what appellate counsel should do, assuming that they had filed an appeal in time, is address whether there are any issues with regard to the effectiveness of trial counsel. Maybe there aren't. We don't know.
Can't that be addressed in a no-merit report, no-merit brief?
Yes, I believe so.
So why send it back to the trial court?
Good question, Justice, and I don't know. I'll confess my ignorance on this part. I don't practice criminal law on a regular basis, but it is my understanding that the matters are remanded from the Court of Appeals to the trial court, and I'm presuming that the state public defender has a purpose for doing that.
Well, your brief asks for, one, counsel, we appreciate you taking this case. You're doing this by court appointment, aren't you?
Yes, Justice.
Good. And I want to thank you publicly, as we do all counsel who come to the court by court appointed, by a court appointment, and who spend their time doing pro bono work at no expense, that is no fee. And so we do appreciate that and congratulate you
It's an honor, Justice. Thank you. Just doing my part.
But the perk that you got was that you got an opportunity to come up to Rhineland.
Absolutely.
See, when you took it, you thought we were going to sit in Madison and you just walk across the street and argue this. Instead, it's 2 days plus. But we appreciate it, and it's going to sun will shine tomorrow, so you'll be in good shape. In your brief, you say this matter should be remanded to the Court of Appeals with instructions that Mr. Siebert be appointed new appellate counsel and be provided a right of appeal, assuring him at a minimum the protections afforded in 80932. And I think that's the point of the questions by Justice Crooks and Sykes, because he didn't think that the trial court handled the case properly. That's how this all started, right?
Correct.
Under 980, he didn't think that his denial of his motion for supervised release was appropriate. And so he had several objections to the way the trial court handled this proceeding, and so he brought it all the way up to the Court of Appeals. And so what he wants now, as I understand it, he wants an opportunity to challenge the trial court proceedings in the Court of Appeals. Now, it may be once he gets there that the Court of Appeals will find that they need further information and might have to send it back for further fact-finding or hearings at the trial court. But the real question is, why not just send it to the Court of Appeals and see what happens?
I understand your question and comment, Justice, and I agree 100%. The fundamental problem here was that there was no opportunity for Mr. Siebert to benefit from a no-merits brief. And I believe that what appellate counsel would do is review the record, determine whether there are any issues of merit. If so, address those on appeal. And again, this is where I confess my ignorance with regard to Chapter 980 versus the criminal statutes. There may be no reason to remand it back to the circuit court, and the appellate counsel may determine that. And if that's the case, so be it. What is absolutely necessary, though, is that this matter be remanded to the Court of Appeals, and at minimum, Mr. Siebert be afforded the no-merits procedure under 809.32.
Right, or it may turn out that appellate counsel will find that there is merit.
Absolutely. In which
case.
And that
will be up for counsel to determine. Okay. And that would be your solution for this and similar cases until there's a change in the legislation, I gather.
That's correct, Justice.
I understood, as a follow-up to the issue, that the debate in the briefs was in part remedy. That is, that you wanted remand to the Court of Appeals and that opposing counsel wants to remand to the trial court, that you take the position on page 5 of your brief that there is no need to, that there's no indication anywhere in the record that Mr. Siebert changed his mind with regard to his intent to pursue post-judgment relief. The issue, as I understand, between the two of you on that remedy is that you say the record is sufficient, that on denial of the motion He said, I want to appeal. A notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief was filed, and indeed a notice of appeal was filed, albeit late. Do I misunderstand this argument between the two of you?
I don't believe so, Justice.
That's
And I maintain that position here today.
Okay, tell me why there is no indication anywhere in the record that Mr. Siebert changed his mind with regard to his intent, and this matter should be remanded to the Court of Appeals as opposed to the trial court. Why? What's your point to counter opposing counsel?
Sure. Thank you, Justice. It's this. The only evidence in the record is that Mr. Siebert asked for an appeal. His trial counsel filed an intent to pursue post-conviction relief, an 809.30 type of notice, even though 809.30 doesn't apply to Chapter 980 proceedings yet. There is no other indication in the record anywhere that Mr. Siebert changed his mind with regard to pursuing an appeal. Now, the objective facts that we have in the record as well are that an appeal was filed. It was filed by his court-appointed appellate counsel. The appeal was filed one day late. The copy of the notice of appeal that is required to be provided to the Court of Appeals actually made it to Madison on the 90th day. So if the court could have been vested with jurisdiction by receiving the notice in Madison, we wouldn't even be here today. But further, what that indicates is that there was no communication by Mr. Siebert to his appellate counsel not to file the appeal. What it does indicate is that appellate counsel simply didn't take the extra effort to make sure that the notice of appeal reached Outagamie County in time. So therefore, the only reasonable inference is that Mr. Siebert maintained at all times that he wanted to appeal this matter, and his counsel simply didn't follow through. Therefore, this is not a Roe type of case where we have to find out whether or not Mr. Siebert changed his mind or didn't indicate one way or the other, so therefore counsel has an obligation to explain the benefits of appeal, and if Mr. Siebert said nothing, then perhaps counsel's efforts were reasonable. None of that really applies here because all the facts indicate that Mr. Siebert said, I want an appeal. He never said otherwise, and his counsel attempted to file an appeal. She just didn't do it in time. So therefore, what will the record show if this matter is remanded to the circuit court? What else will it show? There's no reasonable indication that it will show that Mr. Siebert changed his mind at any time. And in fact, that would be entirely inconsistent with the conduct of his appellate counsel. So therefore, I don't think we need to send it back to the circuit court.
Any other questions?
Justice Brooks. Let me ask one. Do you think we're being too hyper-technical here? You've got a situation where the lawyer says, I'm going to file a no-merit report. She doesn't do so. So the Court of Appeals says, okay, we know you were going to file a no-merit report. We'll do our own independent review. And as a result of that independent review, they found no merit. What's wrong with that? Why do we have to go through this brief in regard, or report, in regard to no merit?
Because I think the United States Supreme Court has already said that it's not simply a matter of technicality in Penson. They said that the Court of Appeals needs to have the benefit of a brief, not simply a conclusory statement, no merit, but a brief highlighting the issues and the potential merit of the issues. And the Court of Appeals then relies upon that and its own review of the record, and that is constitutionally satisfactory. In this case, there was none of that. At best, there was the inference that counsel thought that there was no merit, but the Court of Appeals substituting its own independent review doesn't satisfy constitutional muster of the United States Constitution. And of course, that gets back to the question of, does Mr. Siebert have a constitutional right to counsel? And I submit that he does, because there is a significant deprivation of liberty involved here.
Do you think the Robbins case weakens the Penson case? I know you're relying on Penson, but is Penson weakened by Robbins? Do you think Robbins makes any difference?
No, I don't. And I was a little bit perplexed by the amicus brief filed by Mr. Eisenberg suggesting that Robbins weakens the Anders procedure. I didn't read it that way at all. I read it as saying that there are several different ways you could pass constitutional muster. This is one of them, and it doesn't suggest that Anders is being drawn back, or that 809.32 should somehow be lessened or amended to lessen the procedures in any way, or make them more stringent.
What seems to me your argument is, and that of the U.S. Supreme Court, is based on an argument that counsel can assist the court. Why do you think that Court of Appeals of three judges or this court of seven need the assistance of counsel?
That's a trick question.
That's why we appointed you counsel.
Thank you, Justice. I certainly do not believe that the United States Supreme Court, also being justices, meant to imply that the courts are unable to evaluate the record on their own. But from a constitutional standpoint, I think that the United States Supreme Court felt that there ought to be more than that single tier of review, and the assistance of counsel provides two tiers of review. And I believe that's actually the specific language that they used. And so therefore, in doing that, there is, and quite frankly, the United States Supreme Court draws lines every day in different places, and that's where they chose to draw the line. And that's why it matters.
Counsel, thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice.
Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. I haven't seen you for a while, Mr. Kleinmeier.
No, I'll see you soon again tomorrow morning, though, too.
Okay.
Yes, I'm appearing on behalf of the respondents. It's true that in this case, the respondents agree with that the petitioner is entitled to relief, and I think the Court of Appeals erred in its disposition of this case. We don't go quite as far as the petitioner, though, in the remedy. I think the remedy is to remand to the Court of Appeals to go back to the trial court for a hearing on ineffective assistance of counsel. At this stage, what we have is Mr. Siebert filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals alleging ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Now, I think his petition stated a claim sufficient that he gets a hearing on that. He said he had an attorney. The attorney filed a notice of appeal late. On the face of that, I think he states a claim that his attorney was ineffective. I don't think we should declare, though, that the attorney was ineffective until we've had a chance to hear from the attorney. Now, on this record, I would guess it's probable he's going to go back and be able to show ineffective assistance. But we don't know. And one example of that would be he stated an intent to appeal, but that was in November, I think, of 1998. The notice of appeal was filed 7 months later in June. In the interim, the attorney apparently reached a conclusion there was no merit, as she indicated by which some of this document she filed. It's entirely possible that she discussed the case with Mr. Siebert, told him her opinion of it, and then maybe he wavered on whether to appeal if his attorney thought there was no merit.
There's nothing in the record indicating, as I read this, that at all times that he wanted an appeal. I don't think there's any argument on that.
Well, there's nothing in the record because the attorney's never had a chance to explain what happened. We've never had a hearing on the claim of ineffective assistance. We've never heard from the attorney about why the notice was filed late. Perhaps she'll admit that she just messed up and was late. Perhaps she has an explanation for it that would say, you know, Mr. Siebert told me he wasn't going to appeal, and the day before it was due, he said he changed his mind and wanted an appeal, and she acted as quickly as possible. We don't know that until we've had a hearing.
Why would she file a notice of appeal if he didn't want to appeal?
Well, my point is, maybe he called back at the day before it was due and said he changed his mind and now he wants to appeal.
What difference does that make? I mean,
it may have been too late to get it filed on time.
But they did file it on time, at least got somewhere on time.
Well, it appears that if it had been mailed one day earlier, it would have made it to circuit court in time. So, I mean,
counsel have the obligation to get it there on time? If it was placed in the mail the day before, then you drive it up? You do it by delivery?
She has the obligation to get there on time, but my point is, we don't know, we just don't know whether she has a reason for being late. And Mr. Siebert was wavering on whether to appeal and didn't make a final decision to appeal until the last minute, maybe she has an explanation for being late.
Counsel, up until some, maybe it was the reply brief, I can't remember where, I saw this one fact. I was with you. I mean, and now I have some problems with it. Because you argue that, look, just because he said he wants to appeal at the close of the motion hearing, he could have changed his mind. Just because they filed a notice of intent to appeal within, and I'm making this up, but probably a week of the notice of motion hearing, maybe he changed his mind. The fact that the attorney filed a day late, I'm with you. Maybe the defendant didn't tell her until it was too late. The problem is this, that in Madison, it arrived timely, which means it could have arrived, which means that she had enough time, she the attorney, had enough time to get it to Madison timely. So isn't she under an obligation to make sure that it gets to Outagamie County timely, FedEx, driving it up like the chief said, because the fact that she filed timely in Madison indicates to me that the defendant continued to want to appeal and that he told her in sufficient time for it to be timely filed in Madison.
Well, again, you know, I have to guess because we don't have a record. My guess is the attorney's experience was that whatever day she mailed it, it was going to arrive in Madison on time, and maybe her experience was it normally arrived at the trial court on time. But I think this would be setting a dangerous precedent to declare an attorney ineffective without having a hearing. I mean, we have a series of cases.
Don't we do that all the time in Schmelzer cases? On a petition for review? They filed the petition for review late, and we say and we don't have a hearing.
Well, I don't know I don't know if that's happened. I mean, I'm aware of Schmelzer. I don't know how many other times that's happened and what the remedy has been. And if the attorney comes back and says, it's late because I messed up, and the attorney is conceding that he or she was ineffective, then I can understand just going ahead. But we don't have any comments from...
Well, let's assume that often, I don't know how it always plays out, but on occasion it plays out that we will allow it to proceed under Schmelzer without having any remand for hearing. By the very fact that it's late, we allow them to proceed, and then in certain situations we'll take a look at the petition for review and say, well, we wouldn't have granted it anyway, no prejudice.
Well, there, in that case, it probably doesn't make any difference because the attorney has filed a document, a petition for review. There's something to review. You're reviewing the same thing that would have been filed had it been there on time.
Not necessarily. It could be that no one, the defendant says, boy, I wanted her or him, the attorney, to file a petition for review, and none has been filed. And then we'll order one filed and not have a hearing. I think we've done that procedure before.
Well, okay, but I think it's... I guess I've seen a series of cases that Mockner is being one that keeps being cited, that when an attorney is alleged to be ineffective, you have to have in order to show prejudice and deficient performance, you have to have the attorney testify, have a chance to hear what the attorney's explanation for their conduct.
Does it make any difference that Schmelzer deals with petition for review and therefore no right to a review as opposed to we're dealing with the Court of Appeals where there is a right of at least one review? Is that any distinction that makes a difference as to procedure?
I don't think so, in the sense that both have a deadline, and if the attorney misses the deadline, the claim is the attorney's ineffective. The remedy may be somewhat different, and the analysis of prejudice may be somewhat different depending on the circumstances, especially if there's already been a petition filed, as in Schmelzer, there was a petition on record. I mean, in this case, I'll admit that if there's a hearing, it's probably might be a 10-minute hearing, and the attorney may show up and say, yeah, I messed up. And, you know, if that's the case, then I think Mr. Siebert's entitled to a new appeal. I just think it would be strange, it's a bad precedent to start declaring attorneys ineffective when the attorneys never had a chance to explain their
Mr.
conduct.
Mr. Kleinmeier, why do we even have to get into whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel? What if this court takes the approach that it's clear that where you have someone committed under Chapter 980, they have the right to the no-merit procedure that's outlined in Anders and Penson and Robbins, and that didn't occur here. And therefore, this should go back to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals should appoint appellate counsel, and the new appellate counsel should review the matter to determine whether or not this is a no-merit situation, and if so, to file a full no-merit report. Isn't the problem here that the Court of Appeals short-circuited the no-merit procedure?
Well, the problem is probably shouldn't have reached a no-merit because had it earlier said there was no jurisdiction for an appeal to begin with. If there's no jurisdiction for an appeal, then I don't know how they can argue that you can't reach no merit. You have to have the appeal there first.
But they did. They indicated that they had completely reviewed the record, and they had determined on their own independently that there was no merit. And they did that without the assistance of counsel and without a no-merit report. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And why shouldn't that be the focus of what this court does instead of looking at ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, because the claim here, we have to go back to the pleadings. The pleading is a claim of alleged ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for filing a notice of appeal late. And I think that's the pleading we deal with, and that's what the Court of Appeals sort of responded to, is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for that on that ground. It reached a no-merit type of analysis only because it looked at the prejudice prong of an ineffective assistance claim. And I think that's where the Court of Appeals went wrong, because in this case, the defendant, or Mr. Siebert, was in effect denied counsel and totally denied an appeal. And in that situation, under Penson and Roe, you presume prejudice. So if the counsel is deficient because she filed a notice of appeal late, and if prejudice is presumed, then Mr. Siebert has made out a claim for ineffective assistance. You go back, and I think you have to put him back in a position where he has effective assistance of counsel, which would be an appellate counsel who would not have an opportunity to file a notice of appeal. In other words, give him a new, let his time for appeal begin to run again, a new time for appeal. Now, if he gets the same attorney, she may again reach the same conclusion that there's no merit, and she'd have to proceed the way she thinks is appropriate. A new attorney may find merit and proceed with a regular appeal. I think it's jumping the gun to send it back to the Court of Appeals, assuming no merit is the procedure. I think we have to go back, let Mr. Siebert have his trial attorney, has to have his appellate attorney file a timely notice of appeal, and proceed from there.
Does the state concede that there's no problem with applying the Anders no merit procedure to a Chapter 980 committee?
Well, I don't think the court has to reach that, but if the court decides to, I don't see any problem. In fact, I think, this case can be decided on the ground of statutory right to counsel and just disposing of the immediate pleadings, which gives him a new appeal. If the court goes on and addresses the question of constitutional right to counsel, I don't see any way that he does not have a constitutional right to counsel. The appeal.
He does have a constitutional
right.
It's a statutory right, because he has a statutory right. It's a constitutional right to be effective at counsel.
Yeah, and coupled with the constitutional right to counsel, I think the same, even though it's a civil case, I think under the rationale of Anders, which was based on equal protection and due process, to compare the indigent person's counsel along with the person's counsel who has retained counsel, that was the basis for the Anders procedure to give the indigent person protection. I think that same rationale would apply to this case. So the person would be applied to some procedure. Now, the exact procedure...
The reason for that is because although it's labeled a civil procedure, we're talking about a liberty interest.
Correct.
And you're not quibbling about the Anders procedure, are you? That's what I... Because when I look at the amici, this is Howard Eisenberg. He's basically supporting you know, we've had Anders around for 30 years in the position. Yes, it worked well. Why change it? Why should this court be making any change in that?
Yeah, I think I have a couple responses to that. One, I think that Mr. Siebert and people in his position would have entitled to some protection like Anders. Now, whether that has to, and I think the simplest way is just to follow basically the same procedures, 80932, because that's been approved as constitutional. The attorneys in Wisconsin are familiar with it. I think the time limits have to be adjusted for Chapter 980 cases.
But do you agree with Mr. Seibel that what we do is file the order that the appeal be filed within the time limit set forth by civil matters, but then the Court of Appeals authorize that it go into 80932 so that they can address at the trial court level, if need be, post-conviction remedies?
I think I'm saying the same thing, but maybe let me say it and conclude if it's the same. I think the parties are bound by the 808.04 90 days for notice of appeal.
90-day time.
Right.
Right.
And after that notice of appeal is filed, then most of the time limits are for, like, briefing schedules and so forth. Those are time limits the Court of Appeals has the authority to extend. So I think what would have to happen as a practical matter that the notice of appeal would have to be filed in the 90 days. If the attorney still hasn't had a chance to review all the transcripts enough to be prepared to file the brief or make the decision, he or she could ask for an extension of time to file the briefs to do that. Then another thing is 808.075 is the provision, has a whole series of provisions about when remand is appropriate. I think the attorney could cite that as if the attorney found issues that would need further development. Because that statute is a reason for remand.
In other words, the Court of Appeals would set forth the structure for each particular case, depending whether it needed remand or not.
Right, the attorneys may
be dealt with by the Court of Appeals and the counsel.
Yes, there may well be some cases where the attorney feels that there are no issues that need further development. All the issues have to be discussed are already on the record from the original proceeding. And so they wouldn't need a remand. But the extra time would just have to be the Court of, hopefully the Court of Appeals will grant the attorney time to do it. As to the exact procedure of this, I guess since we're representing respondents here, and typically in most criminal cases, the Attorney General's office on the side of the state, and the state doesn't really get involved in no merit procedures, obviously. That's between the defendant's attorney, or Mr. Siebert's attorney, and the Court of Appeals. So I think our interest in this is not that you follow the Anders procedure or the procedure in 8932 or the procedure in Smith versus Robbins, but it is at least be a procedure that obviously satisfies the constitutional requirements so that we don't face collateral challenge later. I think the simplest way, though, I think the two amicus briefs and Mr. Siebel, I think, are proposing to still follow the same procedure in 8932, and I think that makes the most sense. I mean, the basic procedure about what steps the attorney has to take. The time limits may change, but the basic requirements, both the steps the attorney has to take, I think it's just simpler to follow those in 80932.
I gather what you want, and we're exercising caution in, is that you want a hearing on whether counsel here has been ineffective, that is, whether counsel failed to obey the instructions of the client. Whereas the defense wants to skip that process, thinks it's already been in effect, put into the record, and would like to just go right to the merits, or no merits, as the case may be, of the appeal.
Yes, I think it's important that we find that Mr. Siebert and the attorney testify as to what the communications were. As I say, it may not be very difficult for Mr. Siebert to establish that the attorney was deficient. But I still think the attorney should have a chance to explain her conduct.
How long has this case been kicking around?
The supervisory release hearing ended, I believe, in November, approximately November of 98. The original notice of appeal was the one that was 91 days late, or I mean one day late, filed on the 91st day, was I think June 11th, 1999. And then I think it was later in 1990, late in 1999, I believe, that Mr. Siebert filed his petition for habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals. And then at that time in the interim is for disposing of the Court of Appeals proceeding and getting here.
And he's been in Not on supervised release, has he?
I honestly don't know, but I don't believe so. I think he's had other hearings, but there's nothing in the record here, of course, and I can't say for sure what his status is.
By the time he gets a decision from this, it'll be June 2001, maybe, or close to it.
Could be, yes.
Can you think of any situation under which an attorney would file a notice of appeal when the client said don't?
No, because I think under the Roe case again, and which I think states pretty basic point that the decision whether to file a notice of appeal is up to the client. So I think in this case, it's no doubt that Mr. Siebert in the end said he wanted one. But I think we just have to know for sure that there wasn't some wavering in the interim.
Well, I suppose it's possible that they file something at 5 p.m. or 4:59 p.m. on the 90th day and can't get it up to another part of the state timely because the defendant, I guess I shouldn't call him a defendant, the detained a sexual predator. We won't call him a hostage, I know.
Detainee.
That the detainee, said 4:50, do it. And they do the best they can under the circumstance. Then you might very well say there was no way he could get it up to Allegheny County or anywhere else outside of Madison. But that's not the fact situation here, apparently.
No.
It was all done by mail, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. That's fine. We won't have to belabor that. Anything else, Mr. Conway?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Any other questions for the court? Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, Justice. Very briefly, Justice Crooks, I believe I cited the Roe case, and I meant to say Smith v. Robbins. I trust you understood.
I didn't understand any of that.
I referenced the Roe case when I was answering a question by Justice Crooks, and I meant to be saying the Robbins case, and the
not
justice
Roe
had a
no.
No, no, or state, no, well, in any event.
Was there a transmittal letter that accompanied the notice of appeal?
Not that I saw on the record, Justice. I want to get back to a question that Justice Crooks asked, which was, why can't we just jump to the Anders procedure here? Why do we have to deal with the late filing of the notice of appeal? And the way I can see it, the only potential argument there could be would filed, sent off the notice of appeal, Mr. Siebert changed his mind and said, I no longer want to appeal. And I concede quite readily that in cases where a defendant says, I'm not interested in appealing, and the timeline passes, the court loses jurisdiction, and Anders no longer means anything. However, in this case, the record clearly shows that Mr. Siebert at all times said, I want to file an appeal, and there can be no inference that he changed his mind after the appeal was mailed, which would be the only situation where I could see that there would be a voluntary lapse of the statute of limitations.
Can there be an inference that he, is it possible that he did not finally make up his mind until it was too late to timely appeal? There seems to be little question that he at the end, at the beginning and at the end, intended to appeal. The question is whether or not the lack of timeliness is as a result of anything occasioned by him.
I agree with your observation, however, Justice, that if counsel could have got it to Madison, they could have got it to Allegheny County. And I think that the only inference is that counsel thought it was going to get there by first-class mail, and it did to Madison, but it didn't to Allegheny County, and I think counsel does have an obligation to ensure that that notice of appeal is filed on time and take the extra step, Federal Express, whatever it may be. The other point I'd like to make is appellate counsel isn't on trial here, and I don't see any reason to have a hearing at the circuit court level to exonerate appellate counsel. The issue is whether Mr. Siebert's rights were protected, and the only reasonable inference is that they weren't, and it makes little, there's little benefit to send this matter back to the circuit court for the purpose of a hearing to possibly exonerate appellate counsel when it doesn't look like there's any remote chance that that would be possible, and that's not the purpose of being here today.
Is it necessarily to exonerate or to criticize? It would be just to find out what happened, and that's what I think the state is driving at, to just find out what happened in this case. Or do we just say when they're late, what you seem to want is, and you're not quibbling with Andrews either, you seem to simply are saying that when it's late, what we do, we just start the process, and you don't have, you don't worry about why you came in late.
Actually, Justice Wilcox, I don't take that position.
But that is what I thought I just heard you say, that you don't need to say, you don't care what happened with the counsel.
Well, my position is that, based on this record, there is absolutely no reasonable inference that there was a deliberate choice by Mr. Siebert not to seek an appeal. And therefore, based on this record, there's no reason to remand it. However,
and I would agree with you, and I agree with that.
I do believe that, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been clear that counsel can act effectively by simply discussing the appeal with the defendant, and the defendant could stand mute and not say a word, and perhaps that's effective. And perhaps under a fact situation like that, it would be necessary to go back to the circuit court and have a hearing, but we don't have those facts here. And so therefore, there's no reason for that. And there's absolutely no indication that Mr. Siebert changed his mind after appellate counsel mailed the notice of appeal, because appellate counsel subsequently mailed another notice of appeal after realizing the deadline was late and adding 809.32 language, and then that was in July. The first notice of appeal was filed on June 11th. The amended notice of appeal was filed on July 1, 1999, and then there was another notice of appeal filed on August 9, 1999. So the record seems to indicate that counsel knew that the appeal was late and tried to correct the matter, and it does not indicate that Mr. Siebert changed his mind.
Thank you, Mr. Seibel. Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier, for arguing this case. This is, except for a case where there's been a total concession on one side, this has been the most agreeable case we've had in a long time, and we think we understand the points of difference. So thank you both, and thank you again to everyone from the Ninth Circuit.